From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made just a few days after the midterm elections. Democrats had won a resounding victory in the House of Representatives, taking back control and adding roughly 40 seats. But the party is having its own internal issues regarding some pretty serious questions. And when Nancy Pelosi arrived at her office just days after the election, she was greeted by protesters. Most of the protesters were Democrats. Some were newly elected Democrats, incoming House freshmen, who wanted to challenge their leadership on climate change policy. And one of them was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who joined 150 youth activists for the sit-in. The activists were making it clear that just because Democrats had won control of the House does not mean they trust the party to do enough on climate policy. They're calling for much stronger action than the party has previously taken. And that leads us to several questions. On policy, what does stronger action actually look like? What does that mean? We're going to get specific at this hour. And on tactics, Ocasio-Cortez faced heavy criticism from some progressive voices. She was accused of fostering infighting in her own party, of demonstrating how the left will just eat its own instead of focusing on fights in Washington with the GOP or conservatives. Now, is that fair? Or does the climate action movement need to push harder, even challenging ostensible allies? Our guest this hour will weigh in. In studio, we have Robin Wilt, Brighton Town Board member, former congressional candidate. Robin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Also with us is Sue Hughes-Smith, a member of the leadership team for the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Sue, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And Mary Lupien is a member of Mothers Out Front and a former candidate for Rochester City Council. Nice to have you back here.
Good to be here.
All right, so I want to start with just asking all of you to weigh in on your take on what we saw with that demonstration. And most of the people demonstrating, again, were youth activists who had come from around Washington, but around the country, who are working on these issues. And they were joined by some of these freshman members who took some heat from their own party, but wanted to say, look, I campaigned on stronger action. And if we've got to fight within our party, we'll fight within our party. We're not trying to be destructive. Let me start with you, Robin. What did you make of that?
Well, actually, I did not see that as a division. I actually saw that as a historic marrying of the progressive wing with party establishment at that time. This was not a case where there was infighting so much as progressives were actually taking a seat at that table, which was historic and exciting for me.
Okay. Mary Lupien?
I would agree. I don't think that having dissent necessarily means infighting. It's a healthy activity in any organization. And that young people and progressive-minded people felt that this is the moment to take their seat at the table is incredibly inspiring. And I think that if the Democratic establishment doesn't take notice, that's really where the problems start to happen, because that's where infighting for me. If you're having a big proportion of your party tell you what they think is wrong and what could be improved, and you don't listen, and you instead villainize them, then that's where this division happens. Really welcoming people into the party, that's really where the mindset should be.
Okay. Sue Hughes-Smith.
So just to be clear, I'm not speaking on behalf of my organization.
Okay.
Okay. So I would say that for many of us who are further left on the political spectrum, it feels like the Democratic Party sold its soul to a large extent. Some want to date that to Clinton. Some might date that a little earlier. In its effort to be, more centrist, it really is often viewed as having sold out those who are most vulnerable. And so I think rightly, for especially the younger generation that can see that the last 30 years hasn't been working for their benefit, it makes a lot of sense for them to pressure the Democrats to do better.
Okay. And is this the way you'd like to see it happen?
I don't know. And that's where I would put my RPCC hat back on as a nonpartisan organization, given the real complexities in society in terms of the lack of education on climate change across the nation, on the way the Republicans have taken control of so much of state government. I don't see any solution that happens rapidly enough that doesn't include Republicans in that solution. So it concerns me that we create more and more of a leftist narrative and don't have enough space for a solution that would be embracing or be able to be embraced by all across the country.
Now, some progressive commentators like Ian Millhiser, who is the justice editor at Think Progress and an author, they took shots at Ocasio-Cortez saying, you've been in Washington for a few days now, and one of your first actions is to protest against Nancy Pelosi. But here's what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said in response to that. She was making the point that, number one, what she wanted to do was support the student and youth activists who have taken the time, who've tried to center this issue. And here's what she had to say about Leader Pelosi.
You know, one of the things that I admire so much about Leader Pelosi is that she comes from a space of activism and organizing. And so I think that she really appreciates civic engagement. And really what I'm here to do is just to support the folks who are here.
Okay. And here is Andrew. It's like Andrew emailed it. We got a lot of Andrews emailing. Different Andrew from the first hour, if you're wondering, who just says, Evan, as a conservative, this is music to my ears. The left attacking itself. Trust me, this is a good deal for us. That's from Andrew, a conservative. Robin, you think he's wrong?
Yeah, I do think he's wrong, because I think people like to draw this false equivalency between Tea Party and the left wing of the Democratic Party. And I think while the Tea Party is represents asking the Republicans to stand for the worst, the left wing of the Democrats is actually asking Democrats to be better, to stand for the best. And I think that's an important distinction to make. There is no equivalency between xenophobia and white supremacy and what we're asking the Democrats to do on the left, which is actually to be more equitable, to be more just, to bring more people to the table. Those are all honorable things.
Okay. Mary?
Yeah, absolutely. And the assumption that, I just want to comment on what Sue said too, like that this Green New Deal doesn't make room for conservatives. I don't think that that's necessarily the case, because this job is about jobs and a lot of the things that the Republicans are talking about. It's just that their current leadership isn't actually doing those things, you know, and it's increasing the deficit. And this could actually do really good things for their base. It's just that we have to reframe it in the right way. And I don't see this as attacking ourselves. Like,
right.
We are asking more of our party. We lost the last election, not because of Donald Trump, but because of us. And we need to do better. And this is all focused on where are we going to be in 2020? What is
Absolutely.
Our platform going to be? What are our plans going to be for 2020 so that we can really come out strong?
We're going to get to that 2020 agenda in just a second with some specific policy ideas. What did you make of Andrew's email?
Well, I guess, you know, he kind of supports my concerns, right? I don't know if you've read Out of the Wreckage by George Monbiot. I really like the way he describes the fact that people respond to narratives that describe, you know, how we relate to the world. Right? We had post-World War II, a 35-year period that where virtually everybody was a Keynesian kind of economist perspective, right? That the government came in with the New Deal, and that was so beneficial for lots of people. And then that gets replaced with neoliberalism. And what we need, if we want people to move away from neoliberalism, which has brought all kinds of ills in terms of a growing social inequality and so forth, we need to have a narrative that speaks to people, that they can replace this current narrative with. And I think Mary's right that the effort to reframe as the Green New Deal will have some appeal in that regard, but we have to do a much better job of communicating and providing space for the conservatives to find a place in that narrative.
Let me read a little bit of what journalist David Roberts had to say for Vox.com. He's written on climate issues extensively over recent years. And here's what he wrote in regards to the protest and the sit-in. He writes, quote, I'll be honest. I've seen intra-left disputes on climate change reprise themselves over and over again to no one's benefit. And when I heard about this protest, I felt a twinge of dread. Why target Pelosi, who has always been a climate champion? And how is she supposed to have a comprehensive climate plan already when she hasn't even taken the gavel? Aren't there worse enemies of the climate to protest? But I've come to understand now. The left is making an early bid to set the highest bar possible for the 2020 Democratic climate change agenda. Roberts goes on to say that's necessary and a good thing. And what he highlights in the Vox piece are the coming resolutions that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez plans to introduce, the resolution setting up the Green New Deal. And I'm going to read seven specifics that he highlights, which we can talk about in as much detail as you want here. Number one, 100% of national power generation will have to come from renewable sources. Number two, building a national energy-efficient smart grid. Number three, upgrading every residential and industrial building for state-of-the-art energy efficiency, comfort, and safety. Number four, decarbonizing the manufacturing, agricultural, and other industries. Number five, decarbonizing, repairing, and improving transportation and other infrastructure. Number six, funding massive investment in the drawdown and capture of greenhouse gases. And number seven, making green technology, industry, expertise, products, and services a major export of the United States with the aim of becoming the undisputed international leader in helping other countries transition to completely carbon-neutral economies and bringing about a globalized Green New Deal. So this is what a growing small committee, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, are going to try to introduce in terms of resolutions. And what Robert says is that sets us up for 2020 with a very, very high bar. Now, Sue, you talk about you don't think solutions probably go forward without Republicans being involved. Is that fair to say?
I think given the current political map, yeah.
Okay, especially on the national level. Especially
on the national level.
On the federal level.
Right.
And what Roberts is saying here is, look, you've got freshman Democrats coming in and they are not taking centrism for an answer. They're not taking, well, you know, give a little here. It's we have an emergency. We have a climate emergency and we're going for it. Does this alienate? Can you get people on board across the aisle? Can this pass anything but a Democratic House? Do you think this is a good idea?
Well,
because my guess is you want to see it happen. It's
I
a question
do
of
want
pragmatically
to see it happen.
How you get there.
I absolutely do want to see it happen. And I mean, to say we want to eliminate fossil fuels, that absolutely has to happen if we're solving climate change. So the question politically is, how do you make that happen? Do you introduce a market approach that Republicans could get on board with because it more closely matches what, you know, their ideology? Do you take a ban approach like the OFF Act, which basically would say, you know, in 10 years, these things are going to be illegal? It's what we did with PCBs. We said they're illegal to produce, then they're illegal to transport, and that forces everybody to shift away. So the ideological split is how you make that happen. My worry is we still don't have enough Republicans on board with the sentiment that they have to stand up to the fossil fuel industry and walk away from it. That money is so contaminating the Republican Party is a huge concern.
Okay. Mary.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that this proposition actually also addresses is that on this committee, no one is allowed to take money from the fossil fuel industry when they're giving input on
that's
this
exactly
committee.
That's another thank you for bringing that up. That's
yeah.
Another so you want to be part of this committee that does this work, you cannot be receiving contributions
yeah.
from the fossil
and
fuel
in my
industry.
Little notes here I wrote duh. It makes so much sense.
Okay. But again, I want to ask you on the pragmatic side, if this is the goal that you have, it's one thing to say, this is what has to get done. It's another to say, how do we get it done in Washington, knowing the current landscape?
Right.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's tough. And I think that, you know, with members of Congress, especially who are getting money from the fossil fuel industry, they're not going to be inclined to vote our way. And that comes back, I think, to the local level and building people power and political power to show that this is what we want. And I think that that relies on all of us. Like this movement here, it's not just in Washington, right? It started at the grassroots. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to continue to push to show our elected leaders that this is critical and that this is something that people will support.
Okay, Robin?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's all about building engagement and discussion. And I think when people are presented with the facts, when people are presented with the notion that we can build a better economy, we can do this together, and we can build a sustainable economy that thwarts the crisis that we have, that we will be facing within the next 12 to 20 years, I think people are going to become more engaged.
I see the phone ringing. Well, let me turn this over to listeners here. This hour, I want to hear from you. If you are someone who's concerned about climate policy, climate action, are you a skeptic in the federal government actually doing something meaningful? Are you an optimist now? Are you a skeptic about any particular party? And would you have joined a sit-in there? Robin, if you had been elected, you ran for Congress, if you'd been elected to Congress, would you have joined the sit-in in Leader Pelosi's office?
Absolutely, and probably for the same reasons that AOC did, and just to show support for the youth that were supporting this action. I think it's critically important that we have these voices included in our political process.
All right, so 844-295-TALK, we'd like to hear from you. Are you a cynic? Do you think the federal government has the will and the opening to do something really meaningful, really bold, and maybe even difficult at first? I mean, maybe you're a cynic on thinking that we can't change systems. I mean, we've done it before. We know we have. We know we've got the capacity if we really care about it. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. I'm going to start with Herman in Brighton. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. I know all three of the panelists. Hi, Sue. And
hi, Herman.
Hi, all of you. Anyway, I attended last night a meeting of the Citizens Climate Lobby, one of the environmental groups that I'm involved with, and they made a big point about making climate a bridge issue, not a wedge issue. And here are some of the points that they suggest. Introduce or support bipartisan carbon fee and dividend legislation. The IPCC report recently affirmed that pricing carbon is the best first step to addressing the problem. Introduce, co-sponsor, and ultimately pass bipartisan legislation that reduces our emissions or helps us adapt to the changes climate has and will bring. Join or form bipartisan working groups such as the Climate Solutions Caucus in the House that create an active space for respectful interparty dialogue on the topic. Hold hearings on the topic of policy solutions to our changing climate rather than on the settled science of the problem. And finally, schedule bipartisan briefings with members of your state or region that focus on local impacts and highlight experts from your district, state, or region. I've noticed in the meetings of Citizens Climate Lobby that there is a great optimism there, more so than in the other groups that I'm familiar with, and that they actually make headway. I mean, this Climate Solutions Caucus, which has equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans in it, I mean, that's a big step forward. So, and by the way, I want to say that I agree, of your panelists, I agree mostly with Sue when she has her RPCC hat on about her concerns. But anyway, you're all wonderful activists, and I enjoy working with you, and thank you.
All right, Herman, thank you very much there. Anything you want to add there, Sue?
I agree that, like, I've been going to CCL's conference for the last 5 years, and I always come back restored. And the reason I come back restored is because of the emphasis on the engagement at the very basic level of democracy. And it's not a secret to those of us who are in these meetings to discover how much the conversation is actually more positive in many, not all, but many Republican offices than it actually is in many Democratic offices. I can't tell you the number of times when we engage in conversations and it simply is like, well, the Republicans won't do anything. So until we control everything, we won't have a solution, as opposed to, you know, a Republican office where even immediately after the last presidential election, it was like there were congressional members who said we have to move forward, Republican congressional members said we have to move forward in addressing this problem. We have to find those points that are common ground. And I fault Democrats for not doing enough to reach across the aisle to find those points of common ground. Kansas is getting 40% of their electricity from wind. Texas is the biggest producer of wind in the country. There is no solution to climate change without wind. So where is this conversation happening, right? Five years ago, for every one positive conversation in Congress with a Republican, there were three negative ones. Today, it's completely reversed. They had 28 positive conversations for every one negative conversation. So there is movement. It's not their public face, but there is conversation behind the door. There are advantages, and I think we as activists need to re-energize people at the local level to get re-engaged in what citizenship means and move everybody forward on solving this issue.
Okay, and Robin and Mary, as two people who have run for office and pushed your party to confront tough issues, do you agree with that idea that, and I don't want to put words in Sue's mouth, but it does sound like in some interactions with members of the Democratic Party, there's a bit of a cop-out that, well, you know, we can't do anything yet, so you spend your time talking to other people, as opposed to, hey, number one, how are we changing minds? How are we working together? How are we reaching across? And how are we then preparing to do the really bold, ambitious, sometimes politically hard things? Is there too much sort of twiddling of thumbs and waiting, you know, as opposed to saying, well, it's not my problem. We're not the ones in power yet.
Well, I think people are looking for their representatives to take leadership and take ownership of these issues. I think that people have spoken loudly that they do want their representatives engaged on these issues. And when we talk about it, I think that what resonates with people is the idea of sustainability, the idea of economic viability. Mm-hmm. When we look at the costs of wind and solar and the potential investment in the economy, that's where we should be going in order to remain viable and sustainable. And I think that really resonates with people. So I think our citizenry really wants our representatives to lead. Mm.
Mary, any surprise hearing Sue say that she's had some more openness from Republicans than Democrats at times in these conversations?
Nothing really surprises me in the terms of our politics. I think our Democratic Party has some interesting relationships with Republicans locally. But yeah, you know, when I was running and I had some help from people who were inside, you know, the party, they specifically said, knowing I'm a climate activist, you can't run on climate. You can't talk about that. And, you know, to a certain extent, I toned down what I was saying.
Who told you that?
I have a few names.
No one is listening. We're among friends. Want to know.
Right. No, but and I think that there's an unwillingness to see the changing environment that we're in. That maybe 10 years ago, that was true. But things are changing so rapidly as our climate is changing so rapidly that people are really crying out to see climate talked about in politics. And I know for myself, you know, I really got involved in politics with Bernie Sanders. And as a climate activist, one of the main things that really turned me on to Bernie, you know, there are many, but was the fact that he was willing to speak about climate on a national stage. He was willing to draw the connections between climate and what's going on in other countries. Mm-hmm. In terms of Syria and the civil war really being caused by the desertification of the country and causing influx of people into the cities. So really there's so many issues that you can tie back to climate change, and we're not talking about that as a party. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sustainability, talking about reaching across the aisle, that's a conservative value.
Absolutely.
Right? Like they're not for wasteful spending. They're not for, you know, wasting, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And I do just want to point out that we're talking about the New Green Deal, but one of the ways in which this New Green Deal is ambitious is in the way that it talks about equity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I really love about it. It's a historic opportunity to eliminate poverty, to make us more prosperous as a whole, and increase economic security for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Let me grab another phone call, and we'll work through more of your emails that have come in as well. This is Mike in Greece next. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Is it Robin Wilt with you?
Robin Wilt is one of our guests, yes.
Okay, so she knows me, and she knows about my theory of what causes ice ages. So I represent sort of a dissenting view. I'm saying that it's too late to do anything about the greenhouse gases because they're coming out of the ocean. My understanding is, you can ask other scientists, my understanding is that the ocean is warming and giving off 5 times the amount of greenhouse gases that we produce from burning fossil fuels. So in that case, you know, it's like an engine. Once you start it, you know, the ocean's warming, more greenhouse gas comes out. It warms the atmosphere some more,
okay,
so the ocean some more.
All right, so Mike, we really don't need sort of a lay science lesson. I don't mean to be rude, but that's not what we're talking about here. So why don't you reframe the point here?
So it's a misconception that any carbon tax,
okay,
or any reduction of the amount of fossil fuel burning that we do is going to solve climate change, okay? It's a misconception, and so, you know, I'm sort of looking at the Boston Tea Party saying, why another tax?
Okay, so two things here. What would it take to change your mind on that? What is your mind open that you might be incorrect?
Well, I'm a scientist, all right, so I've looked into it.
Uh-huh.
But if you can find scientists that say the ocean is not warming, that the ocean is not giving off 5 times the amount of greenhouse gas that we produce,
if you're a scientist and you're saying you want me to find other scientists, I can fill a room with scientists who will tell you that you're incorrect on a lot of this stuff. That's not to say there isn't a dire situation here, but I know lots of scientists who say that with direct and ambitious action, we can make a difference here. You seem sold on there's no difference to be made. It's over.
Well, ask the question that I suggested.
Okay.
Are the oceans warming? Are they giving off more greenhouse gas than we produce? Ask that question to other scientists and see what they say, because I don't think you've asked that question.
Okay. And then I guess the question for you is, should we do nothing then because it's too late? We just kind of live, we go on until the planet's not really habitable? Is that sort of the course?
Well, first, I don't think that would happen.
Okay.
But secondly, you have to make a decision. Do you want to spend the trillions of dollars that it takes to reverse what happened?
Yeah, yeah.
Or do you, you know, just, I mean, this happened before. It's a cycle.
Okay, so I'm sort of done with that call. And my, I appreciate it as far as it goes here. But if you are a scientist and you value science, man, get in the room with scientists. There's lots of them. You know some of them, Sue?
I do. And the science is quite settled. And yes, the ocean is warming. In fact, the ocean has absorbed like 93% of the heat. It is still a carbon sink, however, in the global carbon cycle. And we have, our scientists are saying us, about 10 years to really have the best chance at avoiding the worst impacts of climate change. We can, in fact, implement strategies that would draw us back down to a livable carbon level in the atmosphere. You can look at that scientific research in a drawdown. So there's hope. We have to act, and the science is settled. And just the point of what's the best policy, you know, climate action is and should be seen as a fiscally conservative decision. Inaction will cost the U.S. GDP something like 3.8% over the next 50 or 60 years if we do nothing. And that will continue to get worse as more and more storms eat up more and more of our resources as we try to repair the damage.
And that's not even talking about the human costs.
Exactly. That's
we're talking
just
about hundreds of millions of lives.
That's exactly
being
lost, right. Exactly. So. Exactly. You know, so climate action is the best solution. and is the fiscally responsible solution. And I would love to see Republicans come out and be vocal about the reality of that. And we recognize that the contamination with the fossil fuel money in campaigns, look at what happened to Washington State, is a huge problem. And we have to have people organizing at the grassroots level, demanding more of their leaders, regardless of what party they're in, because a lot of cheap talk is just as meaningless as no talk at all.
I have a lot of phone calls and emails to work through. We've lit a fire here. Our three guests in studio who have done work in climate action at various levels, Sue Hugh-Smith, Robin Wilt, Mary Lupien, all with us. We're talking about what happens next in terms of climate policy on the federal level, particularly in light of the recent sit-in that happened at Nancy Pelosi's office, led by a couple of freshman Democrats in the House of Representatives, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, calling on their own party to be stronger on climate policy. Jack, Rich, we're going to take your phone calls in just a second. We got a lot of emails to get through. Let's get that only break of the hour now. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the future of the hemp industry in New York State. What are the opportunities here? And what can you make with hemp anyway? We explain. Then in our second hour, we sit down with Fatima Reed. She won a Monroe County Family Court judgeship, the first woman of color elected to a judgeship in Monroe County. The significance of that election Wednesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Back to the phones we go. Jack in Rochester next. Go ahead, Jack.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
Good.
That last caller sounds like someone Trump would appoint to the EPA.
let's give my I understand the point. Let's give Michael, let's not give him grief. Everybody's doing the best they can with the information they have, and we're all trying to.
Well, actually, I will follow up something that would go along with him, and that is, although I am all for and obviously support the need to reduce the carbon imprint that we're putting forth, it also seems to me that there is a point somewhat in what he said, and that is we are in a situation right now where we're dealing with these major storms. We're dealing with these with the effects of the reality that has been created over the last few decades. In addition to how do we reverse, how do we stop the process, I think what we also need to address, and obviously this is where public funding is going to come in and political will, we also need to address changing our infrastructure, preparing our houses, preparing our grid to be able to take on the coming changes that are inevitable. And of course, reversing and changing what we the path that we're on is essential, but I think we also need to deal with the matter at hand, and as how do we deal with the reality that, yes, climate is changing, it may continue to change, we may not be able to reverse it entirely or in time, or in the meantime, what do we do? I'll listen off the air.
Jack, thank you. I appreciate that. Let's go around the table here. Mary, you want to start? Go ahead.
Well, I know, you know, Sue can speak about this too, is with drawdown. There are how many?
80.
80 mm-hmm. actions that we can take right now that can reverse it. And there are things from, you know, taking care of refrigerants, like things you wouldn't think about, but actually make a huge difference.
I think that was number one, right?
Right. Yes. Right. Yeah. So there is a plan and there is hope. And I think it's really easy for the people that don't want us to do anything to make us all feel depressed and that we have to go stick our head in the sand. But there is a way out of this.
Okay. Robin?
Yeah. And in addition to drawdown, I think there are some governmental actions that we could take. When we develop affordable housing or public housing, use those CDBG grants to make that housing sustainable, make it more energy
Absolutely.
Efficient, and that will help the recipients of the housing in that their energy costs will be lower, and it will help our economy in greening it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, his point is well taken. I totally agree. What we need to be adapting, because we will see a temperature increase regardless of the rate at which we're drawing down emissions. We will still need to prepare for some more changes. So every time infrastructure is updated, we need to be doing it with the new climate reality in mind, so that we're not wasting our taxpayer dollars by just building to the last standard that we had. We need to embrace those new standards.
Not only that, but we also have to be prepared for, especially in this area, we're going to be getting a lot of climate refugees. We already have from Hurricane Maria.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we keep thinking about our city as a shrinking city. It's not going to be that in the next 10 years. And if we're not preparing for, how are we going to feed those people? How are we going to house those people? How are we going to transport those people? Then we're going to be in a lot of trouble.
All right, back to the phones we go. Rich in Rochester next. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, Evan, how are you doing?
Good.
Oh, there's a couple of things I want to touch on. I think my primary point before I thought about the other ones is that I think the environmental movement and the people who want to deal with climate change, because we absolutely know it's real, have to start changing their paradigms. We have to stop thinking like it's 1971. And what I'm talking about is with the new technologies of nuclear energy and that sustainability, because as much as we talk about sustainability, there is no nuclear, there is no energy source out of the ground. If you take out the sun and wind and water, and we should do that. I don't think water is much, but it does a lot of environmental damage. The most benign thing that we can do is nuclear energy. I know that we almost have a dogmatic view of nuclear energy, and no one's taken a second, third, fourth look at it with all the new technologies going on. And also, to the point of the last two callers, the reality is that we're not going to arrest it. We can sit here and we can talk about arresting it, but I think to your point of infrastructure, also changing, not only talking about that we will get refugees, but making it a government impetus to move people off the coast, move them off low-lying areas, move them out of deserts. When we give incentives in this country for people to do things, why aren't we incentivizing the people to move around the Great Lakes, to move around, you know, the Northeast, the South, but inland into the higher elevation? And stop putting all of our money chasing wanting to live on the ocean. I think we our public transportation working harder and harder to become more public. I mean, I sit on highways like in Toronto and New York City, and I look at myself in my car by myself, and the 400,000 people around me, all of us idling, going 5 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things we can do that we must do, but we also have to stop talking. To these old paradigms of, okay, that nuclear energy is no good.
Okay.
I think we have to revisit these things.
All right, Rich, thank you very much. I am not as well-educated on the current sort of scientific feeling about nuclear energy and whether it's part of the future in a big way or not. What, you got a smile on your face over there, Sue.
You know, people debate that. For me, I think we shouldn't try to eliminate nuclear until we've eliminated the fossil fuels. So let's eliminate all the fossil fuels and then embrace that conversation when we get to that last 20%. There are a lot of new designs out there for nuclear. It'd be really interesting conversation with people who are more in the know in the nuclear industry.
But your focus is on fossil fuels.
We have got to end the fossil fuels. So in that regard, I would certainly support the caller's view that in the short term, at least, nuclear has a role to play.
Okay.
And I totally agree in the thinking that we should be proactive with moving people out of climate-sensitive areas. You know, I was listening to what happened in Paradise and the terrible tragedy there. And then the people talking about rebuilding. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, is that really money well spent? And then, you know, the massive amount of dollars that we're going to be spending on these climate catastrophes, and then people rebuild. It's without the thought that it's going to happen again, because it will.
Mm. Robin?
Yeah, I definitely think that we need to focus on the low-hanging fruit, which is reduction in carbon. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take change of mindset as well. We have to think more globally. We have to think in terms of sustainability. And that's going to take a concerted effort, and that's where government can lead.
Mm-hmm. Let me read two comments that have come in before we jump back to the phones and a different mic in Rochester. Teresa writes to us from Webster saying, I've little hope that the corporate corrupt Democrats will ever do anything real about climate, because they will never give up the fossil fuel money. And by the way, Green New Deal was on the Green Party platform in 2016. when we progressives weren't supposed to vote for the Green Party candidate. So it's pretty ironic that Democrats have picked it up now. Not that I'm not glad if the Democrats move left, finally, but I am justifiably skeptical. That comes from Teresa and Webster. Sam writes to us and says, in 2008, President Obama, who ran with a strong environmental platform and who inherited a House majority and a supermajority in the Senate, could not pass comprehensive environmental legislation. We should examine the barriers that existed then. So what's going on here? Sam's pointing out 10 years ago, it wasn't like it was now. Legislatively, the door was open for Democrats to get serious. Mm-hmm. And Teresa's saying she doesn't think that the core of the Democratic Party is going to give up fossil fuel money and get serious about this. Too cynical, or is that realistic?
Well, he was talking about local Democrats, I think.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how much the fossil fuel industry has made inroads with the local Democrats. But, you know, the Green Party, yes, they've been talking about green solutions forever. It's part of their name. But the Democrats who are talking about the Green New Deal are young. The two organizations that came together were organizations of youth, and our youth are leading us in this area. And I have every confidence that they are they have their heads on their shoulders, and they are fighting for what's best for all of us. And so I have no skepticism there, because it's not centrist Democrats who are leading this charge. And if they move, it's because the people have made them move.
Okay. Sue?
Well, I mean, you know, I think the criticism of the fact that we didn't get legislative action in you know, the early years of the Obama administration points to the fact that we as Democrats need to do a better job of mobilizing at the grassroots level. We, or they, whatever, how you want to describe it, ceded a whole lot of ground and just kind of have accepted the fate that, oh, the Republicans will just own this state or this region or whatever. And the reality is that the message of a Green New Deal, the message of jobs, of health care, of a better world will resonate in a lot of communities. And the Democrats need to re-energize by not just giving up on all of these communities.
Okay.
And that's why I was so excited to see the protests in Nancy Pelosi's office, because I do think that this was finally the Democrats listening to that wing of the party, listening to those voices that have been wanting a seat at the table for so long. And I'm optimistic.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do you have any of Teresa's pessimism, saying that she doesn't have optimism for the Democratic Party? She cited some reasons why. Mary Lupien said earlier this hour, when she ran for local office, was told you can't campaign on climate, told that by Democratic Party leadership.
Well, there were demands made, and one of them was that you know, people involved in crafting the solution did not take money from fossil fuel companies, and I think that's a good starting point. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
I will side note that it wasn't leadership. It was just people that were interested.
Okay, fair.
Exactly.
Haven't told me their names yet. I'm going to get back to your phone calls. This is Mike in Rochester. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. I'd like to continue with the skepticism. I would like to know whether the panel or some of these young Democrats who are supposedly very progressive, would they support, like, carbon taxes on all these goods that come from Asia, and particularly China, Thailand, Cambodia, where the pollution is just unbelievable over there? And I'd like to know whether or not they would support something like a carbon tax. And I think that would send a message that we're serious, rather than putting all the burden domestically. I mean, you people probably sitting on the panel there, you're probably wearing clothes that were made in some sweatshop in China. And that's where my skepticism comes in from, because I have not heard anybody addressing that. Because that is a serious pollution problem.
Okay. So Mike, I'm really glad you called, and I think that all the points are fair. I want to just I'm going to work backwards, and I'm going to kick the carbon tax to the panel. But I'm just going to remind our listeners, we had a conversation a couple of years ago now with Zoe Weil, who is a practitioner of a kind of education that tries to educate kids from early elementary school onward about everything that you do in life. You know, clothing you purchase, where's that money go to? What's it support? What does it perpetuate? How do you change systems? The question on clothing is a fair one. One of the things I learned from Zoe, she says, I like to wear nice clothes. I don't want to be the one who buys it firsthand if it's perpetuating a system that's hurting people. Once it is sort of purchased, it's out there in the world, I'll buy it secondhand, but she will not be the initial originator. So I try not to judge people because sometimes you meet people like, and you go, wow, you're wearing really nice clothes. And they go, yeah, I bought everything secondhand. But it's an interesting point of view. And I think the question's fair, Mike, and I'm really glad you raised that. So I'll let our guest weigh in on that, or especially on the question of a carbon tax. Would you support a carbon tax on goods coming from Asia, he's asking. Robin?
I have been very open about supporting price and invest, which is a variation of fee and dividend. So, yeah.
Okay. Thoughts from the rest of the panel?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the international, you know, panel on climate change, for the first time, made a policy recommendation. They almost never do that. They really have restricted themselves to the science. And it is clear that a carbon price is the best and kind of a prime requirement for solving the climate crisis. And yeah, that carbon tax should not hurt just American businesses, right? And so it has to include adding a tax coming into the country, products that are coming into the country, so that there's a competitive playing field, right? So carbon fee and dividend from CCL's policy point of view has a border adjustment component so that it does not disadvantage the U.S. if we were to adopt a climate tax and another country had not.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I just want to point out that part of the tax is also either reinvesting or giving a subsidy directly to the consumer so that they can better afford green energy.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
I would also just add one more point before we get back to listener comments to Mike about something like following your money in terms of clothing, et cetera. There's been a lot of really difficult, I think, reporting by, I think, journalists who want to try to examine the question of when you buy a shirt that comes from a factory where the conditions are substandard and the wages are substandard. What does that perpetuate? And it's not always as cut and dry as we hope it is, and that's not a cop-out. But I do think, you know, and I've made this comment sort of before in this program, for people like, well, I drive a Prius, so therefore I care about the environment. I mean, it's not just one action of one good you purchase. It's a question more significantly about what systemic change you would support, whether that's politically, action at systemic levels, which is harder.
Yeah.
It's harder, but that's why this kind of conversation, I think, is so important now, because if you're going to move that boulder up the mountain, it takes some effort. It takes some organizing.
I do think that, and especially our climate organizations, we should be practicing the values that we preach. And one of the things that I really and get distressed over is when I see organizations selling T-shirts, and they're from Gildan, and they have sweatshops all across the world, and they're not using sustainable practices. But our PCC got their T-shirts from, and actually I did this for my campaign too. Mm, we went to, you know, Goodwill or wherever, and screen printed our own shirts.
Right. Jillian emails, wants to know if we know Nancy Pelosi's reaction to the climate change meeting. Did she welcome it, and has she made a public comment? She has said what you would think are probably the right things. She says she's open to doing even more. And she has been publicly pretty dismissive of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. After the primary this past summer, she kind of dismissed it as a one-off, a one-election situation, not indicative of a sea change in the party. So she was a bit dismissive of Ocasio-Cortez earlier this year. But this time around, Jillian, she says that she appreciates the activism, that she has a history of activism herself, and that she is looking forward to doing more. So trying to answer that for you, Jillian, there. Let me get Lorraine in Brockport. Who wants to weigh in? Go ahead, Lorraine.
Hi. I'm just weighing in on the fact that I don't think you should be talking about what the Democrat Party should do in order to further this, because the environment affects all people.
Mm-hmm.
It's
right.
Outreach to all people. The polarizing of saying, well, it's a Democrat issue or a Republican issue, just shuts down conversation and sends people into their talking points, their echo chambers. And it frustrates me that it seems like, oh, we're caring only about what the Democrats do. Because it can be done across the board with dealing with people who are more moderate. I'm hoping that we get to that point where moderates in both parties can work together to accomplish some important things. So that's it.
Yeah.
I have.
Fair, I think that's fair enough, Lorena, and I actually think that lines up exactly with what Sue Hughes-Smith was saying earlier this hour. Mm-hmm. We do not move forward if this becomes just a partisan issue in Washington or elsewhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we need to support whatever party candidates are speaking out on this issue. They deserve our support. Certainly locally, you know, Irondequoit, Pittsford, and Brighton all have passed the local law for community choice aggregation. Remains to be seen what details they incorporate in that. But, you know, Bill Smith, the Pittsford town supervisor, is out there trying to lead. The Republicans would be well suited if they spoke out more often on climate. If you look at the last election, the young people are voting overwhelmingly Democratic. And when you dig into the details of that, it's because of the climate change. So if Republicans hope to exist 10 years from now, they better change their ideology.
All right.
And one other thing,
yeah.
If people want to get engaged on local, state level, as well as national climate issues, we are hosting a conversation roundtable on December 5th at St. Thomas's Episcopal Church, 2000 Highland Avenue, from 6 to 8 p.m.
Do that again, the details.
Yeah, December 5th from 6 to 8 p.m. at St. Thomas Episcopal Church, 2000 Highland Avenue.
Hosted by whom?
RPCC will have
Rochester People's Climate Coalition.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Right. And we will have members from the Rochester Youth Climate Leaders, Citizens Climate Lobby, Mothers Out Front, and Mark Dunley, who's just ran for Green Party candidate for comptroller, but who has a Green Education Legal Fund, will be in town.
Okay. So this hour we've covered a lot of policy ground. Now you know more about some of the issues that the federal government is going to consider. To Lorraine's point, I won't just say this. These are not going to be just Democratic issues. These are questions for our federal leaders who are considering it. And we'll see not only what resolutions come forward, what pass, what happens to them next. I want to thank our guests for taking the time to be here and to debate these and to talk about the work they're doing in various sectors of our community. Sue Hughes-Smith, Mary Loopy, and Robin Will, thanks to all three of you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely afternoon, and we're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.